Got some tragic news over the weekend, last weekend, about Justice Antonin Scalia.
Yes, Judge Scalia, the loss of that judge was a shock to all of us. I mean, he has just been such an anchor for the Constitution throughout his term. He's a real example of why presidents, their influence can last decades beyond their terms, because President Reagan nominated Justice Scalia, and now he's served for decades, has just been an unbelievable protector of the Constitution. We have been so happy with his stand, his solid arguments, his brilliance, and he'll be, even those who have opposed him on issues, sing his praises because of how well he's able to formulate arguments and to just do all the things. And of course, we grieve for his family and for all those that are closest, but we also have lost something of a national figure in Judge Scalia. We're talking the kind of person here that goes down in history and who's remembered in the history books in terms of the influence that he has had on issues that have been brought before the court during his tenure. He'll be sorely missed. That changes the whole dynamics, frankly, of the presidential race, because now that position will need to be filled. This president that we have now will want to fill it, because he would certainly want to put a liberal justice in there rather than a constitutional one, as Judge Scalia was. The Senate, of course, has to confirm his appointments, and so there will be a lot of politics going on as people position themselves. But the important thing to remember is just how significant it is who we elect as president, because that's who appoints Supreme Court justices, and they can have an impact well beyond a presidential term. I definitely want to acknowledge Justice Scalia's service, and he deserves whatever honor we can give him, and we will miss him sorely.
Back in the Missouri Senate this week, one of your bills that deals with GPS bracelets, I believe, got a committee hearing this week?
That's right. We have had that bill heard before. This was the first time it was heard by the committee that it was assigned to this year, and so it was a new bill for them, introduced to me by one of my constituents probably 3 years ago because of the death of a young woman that the family suspected might have been brought about by the violation of a protection order that was in place. And although the death was ruled a suicide, there's always questions, and so there was that question there. And they came to me suggesting that we might need to do something to help enforce those protection orders. So we introduced that bill and have kept it pretty much the same. What it does, Dean, is that if a person is found and convicted for violating a protection order, the judge can issue a ruling requiring that they order one of these bracelets. Now, before he does that, there are certain findings that he has to make to ensure that this isn't just arbitrarily and capriciously used to limit someone's freedom when they've only been accused. If a person is accused and a protection order is filed, that does not qualify them for getting this bracelet. But if they, in fact, have been convicted of violating that protection order, or if the offense was so severe that the alternative to a bracelet would be imprisonment and it would be holding them in jail, then this could be an option that the judge could offer to them as an alternative to going to jail. What it would do is set up perimeters around possibly a home, workplace, those places where a protected person would be spending most of their time, so that if a violator, a protection order, was violated, there would be a signal sent to a central control station in a law enforcement office, more than likely. They would both be able to dispatch an officer, and they would have a certifiable record that that person had violated their protection order. The advantages of that are, first of all, that they might be able to intervene because they might get there in a timely fashion if there was intent for harm. The second is they have a clear case that the protection order was violated, and the judge can then exercise whatever options are available to him or her because the protection order has been violated. It doesn't have to be observed. They don't have to get there and catch the person, which is the way it is now. I mean, if you're being protected by a judge's order and that person violates that, then you've got to call and say, well, my used-to-be friend is here, and they're not supposed to be here, and they've got to send somebody out. And if that person has left in the meantime, then it's just your word and it recorded. You know, someone will note the incident, and that's it. With this bracelet in play, then there would be a documentation of the violation, and a judge could then incarcerate that person or whatever was felt like it was necessary for the protection.
There's a great deal of time spent on a bill. I believe the second time it was discussed was this past Tuesday into Wednesday. And that was Senate Bill 847.
Yes. If you're not an attorney, that bill may not make a whole lot of sense to you, but it's a collateral source bill. Essentially what it was, for those of us that are lay folks, is that we passed the same legislation relative to personal injury back in 2005. We clarified what was intended when we deal with cost of medical treatment. And at that time, it was made clear in the legislation that the cost of medical was the cost of medical. It wasn't some phantom number that might be printed on an explanation of benefits that nobody ever paid or intended to pay. It was the actual cost that was paid, and most everyone who has insurance knows what that means. The judicial system in 2010 turned that upside down and essentially eliminated that protection by saying no, that the value of medical treatment is not the same as what was paid, but it's some other arbitrary number. All Senate Bill 847 did was say, no, we met what we said back in 2005. If someone enters into the court record or into the trial the cost of medical treatment, it needs to be the cost of medical treatment, not some number that doesn't accurately reflect that cost. So we really were just trying to restore the law as it had been from 2005 until 2010, when a court case was brought before the Missouri court system and the ruling overturned that. It's going to be a positive, I think, for both sides, because in a personal injury lawsuit, you need to know what you're talking about in terms of what the costs are going to be incurred by the victim. Once a court has decided that there has been a fault, the next thing is determining what is the value of the harm that was done. And there are about 9 different items that attorneys can argue, from loss of future wages to pain and suffering. Some of those are punitive, but the cost of medicine is not. It's an actual cost. It's an accounting figure. So 847 simply recognized it as an accounting figure. The recovery of medical costs is intended to be the recovery of medical costs, and everything else is then to be argued under the common law. That's where we ended up. It took us 13 hours to get to a resolution. There was a lot of time spent on the floor. There was considerable resistance, primarily represented from the trial attorneys. I mean, let's face it, they have a significant potential loss anytime we do any kind of tort reform. As we move more and more towards a justice balance, I guess, of value versus a just win-lose perspective, then sometimes those values go down. If I give you the actual cost of my medical versus some imaginary cost, then that value is going to go down. And that means the jury award would be diminished by that amount, and it would be more justly applied, which means that the trial attorney's fees are going to go down. And so there is somewhat of a special interest there that I think may go even beyond whether this is an accurate representation of cost or not.